get the program established. He gave me a contact at Mare Island, an extremely accommodating lieutenant commander.
"What do you want?" he asked. I told him. "What's your input?" he continued, and I told him that, too, about 25 people every 2 months. "When do you want to start the first class?" he asked, and when I told him the following month, he said, "Fine, just have your people report to me."
"What about funding?" I asked.
"Forget it," he replied. "You're talking such small numbers we can absorb it, no sweat."
I was knocked out and told him so. This lieutenant commander, the equivalent of an army major, had full authority to set up a program that in the army would have taken the approval of the chief of staff. The Navy was still damming the torpedoes and moving full speed ahead while the army was floundering on the shoals of centralization. I'd seen it in Vietnam with SLAM, and now even more clearly at the Pentagon. The closer a man got to the top, the more control he wanted over the smallest detail. He couldn't let his underlings be completely in charge of anything. If they screwed up, he might pay the price with a bad ER or a passover at the promotions board. Yet at the same time, he needed those underlings because without them, he'd have no empire to command. And empire building was a human tendency the Army exhibited with great enthusiasm. It guaranteed swollen headquarters under swollen headquarters from the Pentagon on down, all of them justifying their existence through the amount of paperwork they generated, even if most of it duplicated the work being done at the next higher level and nothing came of it in the end. If the truth were to be known, it was a wonder anything got accomplished at all. With 27,000 people working in the Pentagon alone, I always felt that if someone stood at the front doors and told every fourth person, whoever he was and whatever his function, not to show up for work the next day and each complied, the running of the place wouldn't even miss a beat. Except, that is, if they tossed out Hank Emerson and the very rare men like him. Hank rammed good ideas through the bureaucracy faster than even the most sincere and accomplished ticket puncher could say, "Yes, but..." And even when he failed with one thing, he made sure he had a contingency plan to get as close to what we wanted as possible through the back door. We devised a platoon leader's course, for example, when one of our studies revealed that only 11 out of every 100 platoon leaders who went to Vietnam had ever stood in front of a line platoon. Over a 6-month period, the participants in this all-hands-on program, designated the company, would have rotated among themselves leadership of the squads and platoons that made up their ranks, while a seasoned Vietnam-experienced lieutenant colonel infantryman like Frank Dietrich acted as company CO. Though we lost the battle to get that course off the ground, we were able to expand the 8-week Ranger training program, the hardest, most realistic only course in the U.S. Army that prepared young leaders for the war we were now waging, to take more personnel. Under Hank Emerson, said it also got a much-needed orientation and refresher training program going for battalion and brigade commanders en route to Vietnam for the first time, and another essential little course entitled simply The Enemy. But perhaps most significant among SEDIT's achievements under Emerson was the creation and implementation of the Infantry Non-Commissioned Officer Course, INCOC. By the autumn of 1967, 2.5 years into the war, the line NCO shortage I'd noted with SLAM had become critical. It was Korea 1952 all over again, only worse. In 1952, at least the war was defensive. And a good company commander plus just one decent NCO were enough to spoon-feed and forge a team. It was a whole different story in the ever-changing small-unit jungle fighting of Vietnam 1967-68, where, with only a couple of years' service, the average rifle company commander couldn't pour piss out of a boot, much less mold the draftee unit into a cohesive whole. The need for tough NCOs had never been greater, and the absence in force of these old pros on the battlefield in Vietnam was, at least among warriors, great cause for alarm. Hank and I brainstormed the problem, first looking at the mix of men who formed the pool of second lieutenants who fought in Vietnam. We concluded that OCS officers statistically made better platoon leaders than ROTC or West Point graduates because they had more hands-on training. In the long term, the latter probably had more potential because of education and motivation in the areas of staff work and future generalship,
But for the moment, we didn't need staff officers or generals. We needed studs who could whip Charlie's ass and keep kids alive on the battlefield. From there, we concluded that there must be a large pool of capable soldiers coming through the system who would have made good officers, except that they missed OCS entry by a few points on the school's IQ requirement. We designed the NCO candidate course to grab guys with leadership potential out of this pool and get them trained up as squad and platoon sergeants. We modeled the program on OCS, and in order to get it going as quickly as possible, we used much of OCS's support plant, instructors, curriculum, etc. The first candidates were almost all volunteers. They'd all completed their basic combat training, BCT, and advanced individual training, AIT, where their leadership potential had been evaluated. The NCO candidate course afforded them another 12 weeks of training, about one-third of it at night, plus 9 more weeks of OJT in line units or at various training centers around the United States before they began their year's tour in Vietnam. The program looked brilliant on paper, and from the feedback we received, it appeared to work well in practice. The graduates weren't Sweeneys or Presses or Gallaghers, but they were a lot better than a PFC in a firefight who inherits a squad by default, and they provided considerable relief on the ground in Vietnam. DIT Chief Zeiss hung the heavy-duty name of Skills Development Base on the course and forbade us to call its graduates Instant NCOs. Little did he know there were worse such monikers. Within the Army, the instant noncoms quickly and forever became known as shaken bakes. And like all things Army, almost immediately the program was expanded from infantry to armor to artillery and the rest of the service branches. The NCO candidate course, which really was Hank's and my baby, was an essential innovation at that time in the U.S. Army's war in Vietnam. Still, to me, it came second in importance to what I considered the most significant thing I did at the Pentagon, which was a study of U.S.-friendly fire casualties in the war. If my tour with SLAM told me anything, it was that the U.S. Army was its own worst enemy in Vietnam. Hank Emerson agreed, on the basis of his first of the 101 experience alone, and about 2 minutes after I got to set it, he tasked my branch to prepare a study outlining the problem and recommending solutions. At our request, the Adjutant General provided us with all casualty cards, which were the actual tags written in the field by the medics, for a one-year period. While we pored over them, I also noticed the views of respected warriors paying their Pentagon dues, like Hal Moore, the hero of Ya Drang, who was working in the office of the Secretary of Defense. During the study, I was surprised to discover that a new system had been established to count KIAs. Now, if you died after you'd been loaded onto a chopper, you were not KIA, you were DOW, or died of wounds. It was a cynical but clever ploy that reduced and thus made more palatable the percentage of KIAs served up daily by the Army to the American public. But if the Army thought it was fooling the people, it had no idea how badly it was fooling itself. As our study shook out, the fact became inescapable that a staggering 15% to 20% of all U.S. casualties in Vietnam were caused by friendly fire. The paper we wrote, which explored both the problem and the radical changes in training, equipment, and doctrine essential to rectify it, proved difficult for some powers that be to swallow. As Lieutenant General James K. Woolnow, the Desper, wrote to DIT Chief Zeiss of our study, "A most thorough, provocative, and dangerous, public relations-wise, document. If we are really as bad as this infers, all of Westy's and other commanders' comments on how well-trained our troops are rendered false. I believe, in the enthusiasm of the authors, they have unintentionally painted a much too damning picture. Therefore, perhaps you should have all copies classified." Zeiss gladly followed the suggestion, and the true but terrible word didn't get out. Fortunately, General Woolnow did not let the subject drop there, which he easily could have done. He felt most of our points were valid and required immediate attention, and in record time, from a Pentagon point of view, our recommendations were doled out among the appropriate action agencies. Some changes were implemented immediately, and some took a little longer. Our recommendation that the Colt 45 pistol be eliminated and replaced, having caused since World War I more friendly casualties than enemy, probably took the longest, at some 18 years. But the main problem of friendly fire casualties, unrealistic over-supervised training, was never solved. And of the some 58,000 Americans who died in Vietnam, on the basis of our calculations, between 8,700 and 11,600 of them shouldn't have. It was the saga of Willie Lump Lump repeated again and again. Only by now, congressional interference and fear of congressional investigation had weakened the quality of Army training across the board. The irony of this was never greater to me than when the countless congressionals bounced down to DIT and my desk during my short tenure as Chief of Individual Training. Inquiries by congressmen on behalf of the Mr. and Mrs. Lump Lumps who'd complained that their sons were killed in Vietnam as a result of inadequate training. Our job then was to call the training facility the soldier had attended, make sure he had received the relevant training, then rush a letter to that effect back to the congressman via the Office of Legislative Liaison. It was not our job to determine whether the relevant training had indeed been relevant, hands-on, or worthwhile, and after a short time, when we'd answered every possible question at least 10 times, my marvelous secretary, Eloise Whitfield, organized the responses by paragraph and slipped the pages into a book of clear acetate folders. Then, as each inquiry came in, I could call the school, get the training records checked, circle the appropriate paragraphs on our acetate-covered master letter, and have the congressional on its way in 15 minutes. From where I sat in the Pentagon, there was nothing else to be done. AWOLs were a large and growing problem throughout the Army at the height of the Vietnam War. Although I wasn't directly responsible for these reluctant souls, there was no doubt that if they had been trained properly in the first place, the problem would not have exploded as it had. Or so said Lieutenant Colonel Harold Ace Elliott, the Corrections Action Officer in the Office of the Provost Marshal, and he was right. Ace Elliott was an unlikely cop. That is to say, he never struck me as a cop, even from our earliest meeting when he called me at SEDIT about the AWOL problem. Nor should he have, really. Ace was an early airborne infantryman who'd come up through the ranks in World War II and Korea. He'd learned his trade from the likes of Jim Gavin, for whom he had been an RTO. And he'd only left the infantry for the military police when complications from a severe leg wound he'd received as a 187th paratrooper in Korea had him on the verge of being put out to pasture. Like his assessment of the AWOL situation, Ace's solution to the problem was as much, if not more, an infantryman's than an MP's. Establish a correctional facility specifically for the AWOLs where they could get the concentrated training they had obviously not received to date. Well, remembering how bums had become chargers after a stint in the correctional facility of the Trust Stockade, I was enthusiastic about the plan. And in the first of a number of actions we worked on together, Ace and I got his brainchild off the ground at Fort Riley, Kansas, and with Ace handpicking the trainers, the program was a great success. The MP with the infantryman's eyes was soon promoted to Chief of Operations for the Provost Marshal General, and we had occasion to work together again during the fierce anti-war and race riots in Detroit, Chicago, New York, and scores of other cities around the country. The widespread outbreak of violence prompted Harold K. Johnson to order Ace to form a team to go to every police department in the USA to train civilian officers in civil disturbance riot control operations. 37 police departments later, Ace returned to the Pentagon to tell the chief this one-on-one scheme wouldn't be finished until the turn of the century. Once again, he got in touch with me, and with a little help from SEDIT, Ace was soon able to realize his concept of a single school at a central location, Fort Gordon, to which members of the civilian law enforcement agencies would come for the training program. That we were using the military to train civilian authorities to put down disorder, the origin of much of which was the military's role in Vietnam to begin with, among the civilian population was an irony lost on me at the time. Though I knew we were fighting the most unpopular war in our country's history, it wasn't mine or any of our jobs to find out what all the people's hollering was about. It was simpler to set up the mechanism to keep them in line or put them in cages until they calmed down or came around. As tied as I was to my Pentagon job, I still got out among the civilian population a lot during those turbulent days, not just in Washington, where people expressed their feelings about the war outside the White House gates with the chant of, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many have you killed today?" but all over the country. Slam Marshall's Battles in the Monsoon had been published, and because Slam had written glowingly about me and my battalion during the Dock Toe fight, despite incredibly identifying us as the 2nd Battalion, 327th, rather than the 1st, I became kind of an instant celebrity. Before long, I was called upon to join the Chief of Information's SINFO Distinguished Speakers Team, a stable of well-decorated studs who, on request, had to speak-slash-sell the war to whomever SINFO targeted. At first, I did preaching to the choir VFW and American Legion functions, Rotary and Lion clubs, and universities in the Washington, D.C. area. Later, I was appointed the Department of Defense DOD representative to a presidential briefing team whose job was to sell the war through a lecture tour of major U.S. universities, countering in the process, it was hoped, the effects of the anti-Vietnam movement on the campuses. The other speakers on the presidential team were from the Agency for International Development, AID, and the State Department. Our presentation was a slick dog and pony show designed to convince our listeners that America's purpose in Vietnam was pure and that our effort there would bring peace and democracy to that war-savaged land. Most of our audiences were already supporters, but we generally ran into some organized student protest at each assembly, too. There was always a lot of heckling, but after a while, my co-speakers and I each developed perfect put-downs that set the majority of our audiences cheering while the protesters were hustled out or meekly disappeared within the crowd. All in all, the tour was tremendously successful, and the only problem for me was the more I did the round with it, the more I knew what we were saying was bullshit. My aid and State Department counterparts didn't believe what we were saying either. But it didn't seem to bother them as much. My problem was that by this time I was completely obsessed with the war, how we got into it, and the mess we were making of it, and having given up trying to deceive myself, I couldn't stand the fact that I was deceiving the American people. Always before, I'd studied the war from a military angle. For the SINFO job, I'd had to read other things, the terms of the French ceasefire, for example. And for the first time, I discovered that we, not the North Vietnamese, had violated the terms of that agreement. That we had refused to allow the planned plebiscite in 1956 to decide whether Vietnam would remain divided or be reunited, because the result, a reunited country with Ho Chi Minh at the helm, was as unacceptable as it was easy to foresee. In years to come, this and other ironies would be common knowledge. But back then, to me, they were a whole new set of truths, and they gave my view of the war a schizophrenic quality. "Maybe we shouldn't be there at all," said one voice in my head. "But we are there, and we are not leaving, so let's get with it," said the other. And that was the voice I listened to, because that was the military angle again, the one I felt I could possibly do something about. I found myself searching wildly for a magic solution. The Army was my life, and I could not accept that this situation, my mother, my father, my only real sustaining love, could blow it so badly. In the stacks of the Pentagon Library, I found dozens of after-action reports covering the French experience in Indochina, 1946 through 54. The French had well documented every operation. Translated into English, their frustrations, failures, and lessons learned were exactly the same as those that U.S. troops were experiencing in 67-68. Yet a lot of people really must have believed the American four-star general who suggested that since the French hadn't won a war since Napoleon, nothing could be learned from them. Judging from the unmarked due date form on the front of each book, not one of these French after-action reports had ever been checked out. Neither had Modern Warfare, the insurgency treatise of one of my renegade mentors, French Colonel Roger Trinquier, available in English since 1964. The fight against the guerrilla must be organized methodically and conducted with unremitting patience and resolution, wrote Trinquier. Except for the rare exception, it will never achieve spectacular results so dear to laurel-seeking military leaders. It is only by means of a sum total of perfectly coordinated, complex measures that the struggle will, slowly but surely, push the gorilla to the wall. And yet, there we were, getting wrapped around the axle with big unit missions just like the French before us, arrogantly looking for the decisive battle and the attendant glory, while the unread trinquier gathered dust in the Pentagon library. I had to do something about all this, to educate my apathetic colleagues and do my part to turn the tide of the war. I began to write articles, shooting for one to be published every month in one of the military magazines. Given the amount of time I was on the road speaking, there was never any more light at the end of my inbox than Westy had at the end of his tunnel in Vietnam, so I took to writing in my car on the way to work, with traffic flowing at about 5 to 10 miles per hour and a CW Morse code key clamp to hold my clipboard on my knee. It was quite possible to write a good solid paragraph in the 11-mile stop-and-start trip between my house in Burke, Virginia, and the Pentagon. As soon as I got to work, I'd give it to my secretary to type when she had a chance. It paid to be tight with your secretary at the Pentagon. If you liked each other, she'd always expedite your work, put your periods and commas in the right places, and watch out for your flanks. And between the two of us, we'd rewrite, retype it 3 to 6 times at odd moments throughout the day until it was perfect. That night, I'd take it home, add it to my finished stack, and start the next paragraph the following bumper-to-bumper morning. The final products, which appeared in such magazines as Army, Army Digest, Military Review, and Infantry, generally sought to redress what I considered some of the worst of our Vietnam failures, and or to provide how-tos from my own experience and study. I was greatly encouraged to write by Ward Just, the Washington Post journalist who'd gotten hit with the tigers at Dock Tho, now recovered from his wounds and living in Washington, D.C., where he was assigned to cover the Department of Defense. Ward was to have an inestimable impact on my thinking during this period. 2 years before, Doc Raphael Benjamin had asked questions that opened my military mind and sprinkled seeds in my brain. Now Ward cultivated these budding thoughts. He had just completed a book, To What End?, a collection of pieces born of his Vietnam experience. He asked me to review it, and the manuscript brought home to me that not only was the war effort madness, but we were probably fighting on the wrong side. Ward was no preacher, but his feelings toward the war, in black and white on the pages of his book, were a major step in my enlightenment. As I looked at the political side of the war, a war much more of America's own making than I'd ever thought before, I realized for myself that the goal of the conflict should not be the defeat of the enemy. Beside the fact that such a result was militarily impossible on our present course, it was clear that an American victory would not address the fundamental problems that had fueled the conflict all along and sent so much of the population down the communist road. Instead, what the goal had to be was the rebuilding of the nation by itself, from within, and along democratic principles. But how could this possibly happen? The people hated us. It was only the kids who shouted G.I. number 1, Ho Chi Minh number 10, in the same breath as their rapid fire, you got gum, you got candy, you got sea ration? In cities and villages alike, we moved families from their ancestral homes with the same disregard for their culture and religion as we'd shown the red man in America, and made them prisoners in strategic hamlets about as free as concentration camps. Meanwhile, we ruined their crops with our chemicals and their economy with our Yankee dollars, supported a chain of corrupt governments and a corrupt Viet military machine, and won hearts and minds by destroying villages to save them. It had taken me this long, but I finally concluded, as Bernard Fall and a number of the more sensitive journalists in Vietnam already had, that unless some extraordinary miracle happened, the war was irrevocably lost. But in the Pentagon, there was nothing I could do about it anyway. I gave up my quest for a magic solution, though I did continue to write articles for military publications. I continued my studies of guerrilla warfare also, and began to clip every news item I found in the Washington Post and New York Times on guerrilla incidents and activities in Latin America. "That's where it's going next," I told Ward during one of our many meetings, "because the bastards think they can win it all now." When he asked me where I'd be in 10 or 15 years, I said I'd be Commus MacEl, Commander, U.S. Military Assistance Command, Latin America. But I wasn't going to screw things up as Westmoreland had in Vietnam. I was going to follow Slam Marshall's advice and become the expert on Latin America in the U.S. Army, on the history, language, culture, values, religion, you name it, and how to fight a cheap and efficient counterinsurgent war down there when Castro, with Soviet assistance, started playing his cards against the gringos. Meanwhile, life at the Pentagon went on, and I was tasked to brief the Chief of Staff, the Army Staff, and the Army Commanders on all the goings-on at DIT at the Quarterly Army Commanders Review. The middle-range anxiety I'd gotten used to feeling while working at the Pentagon soared to apoplectic proportions at the thought of addressing some 44 stars in one room. I started rehearsing a full week before. Over the weekend, I took almost 3-year-old Joel with me to the Pentagon briefing room where the real thing would occur, sat him on the very chair General Johnson would sit in during the briefing, and recited my report to him until he was so bored it would have been inhumane not to take him home. The morning of the briefing, I bolted out of bed before the alarm, showered, shaved, and dressed to perfection. Just as I was about to head out the door, Patty turned over in bed. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Work," I whispered.
"At midnight?"
I carefully got undressed and got back into bed, but sleep wouldn't come. So I just laid there at attention, rehearsing the briefing over and over until the alarm went off some 5 hours later. The Pentagon was one uptight place. My briefing for the Army Commander's Review went well. When I finished, I took my place in the back row with the other Indian-level briefers to await the discussion of Ranger training, which I'd made sure was placed on the agenda for the meeting. During the period, Hank and I had been studying the feasibility of expanding the Ranger program. I'd noticed that despite the mere 1,900 Ranger spaces available per year at that time, per class there was a continual shortfall in enrollment. This was a big concern. Besides being the most valuable training available, Ranger School was very expensive to operate, and I had to ensure it was filled for each and every class. So I'd set up a program to monitor input very closely and alerted the Army staff to the problem. By getting the subject placed on the agenda for the Army Commander's Review, the whole purpose of which was to discuss the most important issues facing the Army at the time, a lot of pressure was brought to bear to get people thinking Ranger. Meanwhile, I discovered that a major cause of the shortfall was that while DA paid for a soldier's Ranger training, the Army to which the soldier belonged, 1st Army, 2nd Army, etc., had to pick up the tab for his round-trip transport to Benning plus 20 weeks per diem. So it seemed that the Army commanders, in the effort to save money, were giving the first chop to the only course in the Army that produced qualified battlefield leaders. The subject finally came up at the quarterly review, and one of the armies reported a 300% increase in Ranger training input. The Chief of Staff was delighted. "Yes, sir, we've really been pushing it," the reporting Army CG said proudly. The Chief looked back toward me. "Hackworth, are you pleased with the progress we're making on Ranger training?" "Well, sir," I replied, "the 300% figure just mentioned is based on the fact that for the past 6 months, this particular Army has had zero input into the Ranger program when it should have been sending 22 people each time. This last quarter, it sent 3. Which is indeed a 300% increase, but it's still shortfalling 19 people. A flustered 3-star sent me an "I'll get you later" look, but those were the breaks. Figures don't lie, but liars figure. I'd learned early in the piece the unofficial motto of the 5-sided puzzle palace. Throughout this period at the hub of Army decision-making, I also tried to rectify some of my pet hates. Among them, the M16 and the Command Musical Chairs Rotation Policy. An old paratrooper friend from Campbell was the action officer for the M16 in the Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Force Development, Axe 4. I went to see him and tried to persuade him to stand in the door over the weapon. Even though the system had endorsed it, he agreed with me that it was far too delicate for infantry, probably on any battlefield, much less in a jungle rice paddy setting like Vietnam. But like most of us ticket-punching drones in the Pentagon, this action officer was very career-minded, and despite his being the person in the U.S. Army who could have made the difference, he couldn't bring himself to buck the system. As I was leaving the office, another guy even piped up, "Don't fight it, just buy Colt Industries." And so the saga of the M16 went on. Time would prove that one of the major problems with the M16 in the war years was its ammo, bought on the cheap by an army cutting costs at the expense of its men's lives, and later, when the ammo situation was straightened out and the mammoth teething problems were addressed, the weapon did get better. But in the final analysis, that situation, as obscene as it was still secondary to the fact that the weapon was a worthless piece of junk that never should have gotten down to the troops to begin with. Initially, I had better luck on the command musical chairs question. Over time, I'd become friendly with one Dr. Martin Bailey, who was working in Assistant Secretary of Defense Elaine Enthoven's Systems Analysis Office. Bailey was one of those PhD whiz kids who were trying to make sense quantitatively of all the data coming out of Vietnam. Army guys generally didn't go out of their way to talk to these brainy types. In truth, most of us were scared shitless of McNamara and his entire crew, and demonstrated it by ridiculing everything to do with them or their beloved systems analysis. But Dr. Bailey was very approachable on those occasions I had cause to work with DOD personnel, and we actually seemed to agree about the stupidity of it all. When I felt confident I could express my views to him without having them boomerang back on me, I broached the subject of the Command Musical Chairs program. Speaking as a soldier, I told him that constantly rotating company, battalion, and brigade commanders through Vietnam was not leading to an army with great depth and experienced battlefield leadership, as OPO was crowing, but instead to the loss of more blood and more lives, the presence of more dilettantes/ticket punchers in vital command roles, and a criminal lack of continuity on the ground. As John Paul Vann would later express the latter point, the U.S. was not in Vietnam 10 years, but 1 year 10 times. Bailey agreed that it did not seem the best way to win a war, so I suggested he send a letter to the Army through McNamara's office, simply asking why our brigade, battalion, and company commanders changed so frequently, and why they couldn't stay in place longer. Dr. Bailey wrote the letter. It bounced from McNamara's office down through the Army Chief of Staff to General Zeiss at DIT. Zeiss gave it to Hank Emerson to answer, and Hank, who didn't know I had anything to do with it, gave it to me. "Hack, I want you to take care of this." I couldn't believe my luck. "Yes, sir," I replied. "Any guidance?" "Shoot it down," Hank said. I couldn't believe my ears. Shoot it down? You know as well as I do that's the crux of the whole damn problem over there. I know, and I'm sorry, but that's the guidance from Zeiss and the Despers and the Chief. "No, sir," I said. "I won't do it. I can't." In my incredible naivete, I just assumed Bailey's question would catch the Army with its pants down, and it would have to confess that it had been so eagerly punching tickets that men were being sent into battle improperly led. Then, according to my scenario, the Army would immediately take action to rectify the problem, and many more young men would live happily ever after. I realized I didn't know the system as well as I thought I did. In the end, Hank got Major John Rogers, the budget branch chief, to do the paper. I watched him working on the thing, secretly praying he'd get stuck and have to give up. But he didn't. The conclusion finally arrived at was something like, "Having culled through our World War II and Korea battle records, it has been determined that in the Italian campaign, a battalion commander lasted 32 days, in the South Pacific, a battalion commander lasted 64 days, and in Korea, a battalion commander lasted 68 days. So in Vietnam, our battalion commanders are getting 3 to 6 times more experience than they did in World War II and Korea. And by the way, we won those two wars. So, Mr. Civilian up there in your ivory tower, go back to sleep. This doesn't concern you. The Army knows what's best." My next attempt at causing change was a book Ward helped me tee up with Stackpole Press, The Platoon Leader's Combat Guide. I was already correcting the galley proofs when the publishers called to say they wanted me to change the entire thrust of the book to make it less Vietnam-oriented and more institutional. Located in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Stackpole must have picked up the optimistic drumbeat from Carlisle Barracks and the Army War College just a stone's throw across the river. They felt the war would soon be over and wanted my book to be less perishable. I told them the Vietnam War had some way to go yet, almost 6 more years of U.S. military involvement, as time would prove, and that I'd contracted to write a book designed to keep our platoons alive there and to sharpen their combat skills. It quickly became clear we were two immovable objects, and it was no big surprise when the project fell through the cracks, as one might say, and usually did those days, in Pentagon ease. Fortunately, I got a lot of the information out anyway, in articles based on the finished chapters, and I didn't have to give back the $7,000 advance, which had been a windfall to Patty and me. Majors and lieutenant colonels on Pentagon duty could starve in Washington, D.C. The cost of living was so high and the salaries so low that to own your own home was an incredible luxury, and whatever little money you had left over tightened in direct proportion to every inch each of your children grew. By no means was I the only one trying to effect change in the Army at this time. Another was one of my great heroes and one of the greatest trainers the U.S. Army has ever seen, General Bruce Clark. Throughout his career, Bruce Clark had been a leader of men, with more than 43 years in uniform. Not once did he serve in the Pentagon. He'd gone from command to command in peacetime and war, commanding in combat a squad in World War I, a corps in Korea, and being the unsung hero of the Battle of the Bulge when his 7th Armored Division Combat Command held San Viet against the German counteroffensive in December 44. In 1967, when I saw him, white-haired and in civilian gear, walking by my office in the C-ring of the Pentagon, he'd been retired 5 years. I jumped up and went into the corridor to say hello, although I knew he wouldn't remember me from our only previous meeting 8 years before, in Germany, when he'd interviewed me to be his junior aide-de-camp. As it turned out, the general was knocked out that I recognized him, and our talk of the old days, 7th Army Berlin and Colonel Johns, as we walked down the hall, was the beginning of a fine relationship. From time to time he'd write me letters asking for information, or send me studies and ask for my views. I soon realized Clark, too, saw the Army he loved slipping, and was single-minded in his post-retirement effort to get it back on track. I often thought about him as it became increasingly clear to me that the track had been destroyed, and as I wrestled with my own future, because during those Pentagon days my career, too, had come into question. Should I stay in and try to repair the Army from within, biding my time until I got to the top and could flush the whole thing out, or resign while I was still young and could do something else? General Zeiss once told me if he didn't get a division command in Vietnam, his next vital punch, he'd get out early, become a vice president for General Electric or some other big company, and not look back. Because even if you stay in, he said, what have you got when you leave the service after a really long career? A handful of ashes. Zeiss, a highly decorated, movie star, handsome, charismatic, longtime paratrooper and comer in the Army, was always a good one for one-liners and the occasional turn of a phrase. But that one, a handful of ashes, was almost too good, saying it all too well for the Bruce Clarks of the Army, who, as impassioned and as vital as they'd been when they were known on sight by perhaps hundreds of thousands of troops, just a few years later, could walk unrecognized and truly powerless down Pentagon halls. While I remained undecided about my career, Tim Grattan, my first of the 18th Vanguard buddy and the finest young infantry officer I'd ever known, called me to say he was hanging up his suit. He was well on his way, but his basic nature of calling a spade a shovel, he said, was going to run him afoul of the system sooner or later. So why not get out while he had the ideas and energy to start afresh? I was sick. It wasn't that Tim was not in good company. Regular Army captains, young majors, and NCOs with up to 14 years' service were resigning in droves these days. It was just that I couldn't think of one good rebuttal for his grounds for quitting, much less give him a decent reason to change his mind. I walked into our little Senate office one day to find Hank Emerson listening intently to a wild-looking, very strange man he introduced to me as a cave expert. The guy was giving Hank a whole routine about how, through his knowledge of caves, he was sure he could pinpoint the Viet Cong's underground cave and tunnel complexes throughout Vietnam, and he wanted to go over and give it a try. Most army comers wouldn't have given this sort of fellow the time of day, but Hank, who was one of our army's few lateral thinkers, was always open to the unusual, and besides, what the guy was saying made sense. If the location of the tunnels and caves were known, they could be systematically destroyed. So, after checking him out through a Washington speleologist's organization and finding out he was for real, Hank bought the idea and, in his characteristic way, blasted through all layers of red tape virtually overnight to convince the chief of staff that this guy should go to Vietnam immediately. A cable was sent to the Hawaiian headquarters of Admiral U.S. G. Sharp, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, SyncPAC, strongly recommending that our newfound speleologist be given the green light for his study. As the strategic headquarters for the war in Vietnam, SyncPAC had to approve all such things, though why, 5,000 miles from the war zone, SyncPAC was the strategic headquarters for the war in the first place was a totally unanswerable mystery, particularly given how completely out of touch the command was with what was happening in Vietnam. Predictably, the answer on the cave expert was no, and it was yet another good idea trampled in the dust by just another big, far-removed headquarters that needed something to do. Another solid layer of World War II thinking, closed-minded, unimaginative bureaucracy throwing around its weight. The irony was, of course, that the tunnels and caves in South Vietnam were the Viet Cong's secret weapon. Regardless of what after-action reports for Operation Attleboro, Cedar Falls, and Junction City had to say, while sections of the tunnel complexes were destroyed by the Americans, for the most part they survived our bulldozers and B-52 runs and the rest of the technology the U.S. war machine brought to bear on them throughout the war. Both the Tet Offensive in 68, which more or less signaled the end of the U.S. war effort in Vietnam, and the final attack on Saigon on 30 April 1975, which finally ended the war, were launched from the VC's labyrinth of tunnels and caves that stretched over an entire area of some 100,000 acres. Things seemed a hell of a lot less bleak the morning I got hold of a copy of the Captain to Major promotions list. All of my guys from the 1st of the 327th, Peeping Tom Hancock, Ben Willis, Wayne Dill, Don Chapman, Glenn Mallory, had made it below the zone to major. I was prouder than a new father. And since promotions lists were supposed to be about as closely held as the most secret of war plans, I waited at least 5 minutes before calling each man to give him the word. I waited another 5 minutes to call Ronnie Brown, one of Emerson's second of the 502nd studs, who'd also made the 5% list. It took me that long to believe what my eyes were telling my head, that his name was even there. It wasn't that Ronnie Brown wasn't a good soldier. In fact, he was a great one, a natural fighter, and a dedicated leader and trainer. But he was also way up there with Dale Leclerc as one of the animals I have known. He even looked like an animal, rivaling the Abu with his tough, squat, maybe 5'4" gorilla body and a face the dead ringer of a bulldog. Ronnie graduated from West Point, but how he'd gotten through was one of the unsolved mysteries of the 20th century. He had a tendency to laugh uproariously in the face of any authority higher than his own, and he probably set a record for walking off demerits at the point for insubordination bordering on the suicidal. Just one example of his problem with authority in those formative college days was the speech he felt compelled to give as captain of the 150-pound West Point football team to the entire corps of cadets and officers the night before the all-important Navy game. "I don't give a damn about West Point," he said, "and I don't give a shit about the black, gray, and gold. And screw all the men who came before. We're going out there and kick Navy's ass for me, Ronnie Brown." In the end, Ronnie defied all odds and graduated with his class. At Fort Campbell, where he was first assigned, He defied all odds by not being court-martialed. First, he ring-led a drunken hose-down party in the BOQ. One of his gang had a girlfriend down for the weekend, and when the two took an early evening siesta, Ronnie and company stuck a fire hose under their friend's door and flooded the place. Then they took a fire axe and chopped through the door. All this would have been bad enough, but then the gang did the same to the rest of the rooms in the hall. The only thing that saved Ronnie from a cell at Leavenworth that time was the fact he wasn't alone. So many guys ended up being involved that in the end, they all got off with an official reprimand. Ronnie didn't fare quite as well when he lost about $5,000 of his company's payroll while standing in the middle of a bank. Not only did he have to pay back every cent, the Army withheld his pay for about 2 years, but he also received an Article 15, which in the Army of the day was a basic guarantee he'd be a candidate for premature retirement. And that was before the ugly fight he got into with members of the 501st Signal Battalion in the Officers' Club. Finally, he was sent down to the Recondo School, whose instructors all had a tendency to be uncontrollable animals, as deputy commandant. In his element, he acquitted himself well there, as he did again in Vietnam with the 2nd of the 502nd, and when he returned to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, where he won the honor of best instructor. Even so, in the warrior diplomat zero-defect army world of the mid-60s, it would not have been unfair to say Ronnie Brown was not field-grade officer material. Yet, there he was, on the 5% promotions list. So I called him on the phone. "You've got to be kidding me," he said when I gave him the news. "Are you sure you've got the right guy?" I read him his service number. "You've got to be kidding me," he repeated. "With my record? Man, Hack, if the Army's that fucked up, I'm quitting." And that was it. He quit. Counterproductive as it turned out to be, Ronnie Brown's place on the promotions list proved that at least some of the less refined battlefield animals, the real warriors, were getting through the system. It was unusual. As General Zeiss explained, old blood and guts leadership was neither needed nor desired by an army that now placed management and executive skills well above those essential to inspire men or turn around an army on the ropes, even in the middle of a war. In 1967-68, Grant, Teddy Roosevelt, Patton, Gavin, Ridgway, and Van Fleet wouldn't have stood a chance. Zeiss, on the other hand, went out of his way to fill his directorate with combat studs. So I always thought he bemoaned the direction the Army had taken as much as I did. But then came the day I tried to get a young major who'd worked for me in the 101st, now over at Fort Belvoir and very unhappy, to come to DIT as a replacement for Bill Kesterson, who was leaving for less squalid pastures. I took Zeiss the major's personnel file for consideration, and later that day he called me in. "This guy," he declared, "he's not our kind of man." "Why's that, sir?" I asked. "First of all, he doesn't have any medals." "What's that got to do with it?" "You have my assurance he's a good man. And he doesn't have any gray in his hair. He's got a master's degree in nuclear physics. He's a young, skinny-looking guy, Hack. He's not a stud. I want studs with a little gray and a blaze of medals." "Sir," I replied, "I can't believe these words are coming out of your mouth. Since when do you have to be a hero to shuffle papers?" "My staff is a reflection of me. When the chief of staff or the desper looks at DIT, I want him to see studs. All studs. I have a fine stable now, and I'm not bringing in any limp dicks. This man is not acceptable." The boss is always right, even when he's wrong, and the major didn't get the job. Meanwhile, I was left surprised and disappointed. The good of the Army was no more at the root of Zeiss's partiality to warriors than it was of the clerk's desire to zero the warriors out. It was all just part of the big scramble to get ahead. And ironic to me that just as junior officers would grab onto the coattails of up-and-coming superiors, the up-and-coming superiors were always on the lookout for what they perceived to be up-and-coming juniors to propel them ever starward from below. The big problem with these relationships was that, for the junior of the pair, if too strongly identified with his patron, the end could come without warning and finish a promising career. One colonel I knew, a combat-savvy DSC winner well on his way to a star, or maybe even two or three, actually put in his retirement papers the day after his general had a stroke and medically retired. No chance for me now, he explained with a shrug. And despite his having a hell of a lot left to offer, it was true. Politically speaking, the Army was broken down into a number of unofficial clubs, airborne, tanker, POW, aviator, etc. And the object for the career-minded was to maneuver himself to be a favored son of one or preferably more of the older members in the club to which he belonged. Military Academy graduates also had a safety net organization in the form of the unofficial but very real West Point Protection Association, or WPPA, whose members took care of their own. Then, if a guy was lucky, he'd find himself in the right club at the right stage of his career. For example, it didn't matter that airborne was inappropriate for the counterinsurgency war in Vietnam, or that Westmoreland, as an airborne artilleryman, was even less appropriate as an overall commander. The fact was that with Westmoreland in command in Vietnam, the airborne club ran the show, and a hotshot airborne officer had much greater command and career opportunities than he might in another branch. When Westy came back to Washington to become chief of staff, the tankers got in the driver's seat in Vietnam, as Westy's Commus MacV replacement, General Creighton Abrams, gradually surrounded himself with cardholders of the tanker club, of which he was a charter member. Why the Army, in its infinite wisdom, chose an airborne cannon cocker, with his entire frame of reference being that of protecting his artillery, Westmoreland was directly responsible for the unwieldy fire support bases in Vietnam that destroyed U.S. mobility and initiative on the battlefield. And then a tanker for the top job in what was nothing if not an infantryman's war was something for future historians to decide. But at least Abrams, whose formidable reputation as a ruthless badass was only matched by his undisputed combat savvy, actively sought the opinions of officers who'd served there. After it was announced that he was to become Westy's MacV deputy and likely successor, Vice Chief of Staff Abrams started calling us into his office. My one-hour interview with him consisted of exactly one question. If you were Commus MacV, what changes would you make? Then the vice chief said nothing for what was for me a very uncomfortable hour. His blue eyes seemed to penetrate like an X-ray right through to my brain as he nodded occasionally and emitted gruff little grunts while I talked and he took notes, all the while chewing on a huge cigar. What he was thinking was anyone's guess, but when time passed and he took his place as Commus MacV, it was obvious Abrams had taken to heart suggestions that I and others like myself had made. If you can't eat it, wear it, or shoot it, don't bring it, was his solution to the blowout luxury that had occurred under his predecessor. In terms of tactics, he started replacing the wasteful search-and-destroy missions with extensive economy-of-force operations such as long-range reconnaissance patrols, LERPs, and phasing out the CIDG border camps. On the other hand, these changes also coincided with the end of the Tet Offensive and the Khe Sanh Siege, two milestones of the war that could not help but affect the way it was being waged. Contrary to official U.S. reports, as of late 1967, the NVA was having great success in the Central Highlands and border areas. A month-long enemy siege at Con Tien, a Marine outpost near the DMZ, never developed into a full-scale enemy attack, but 1,000 Marines were wounded or killed by continuous NVA artillery shelling on their position. 22,000 tons of American bombs were dropped by ever-faithful B-52s throughout the siege, until the Communists finally slipped away and Westmoreland pronounced Con Tien a crushing defeat for the NVA, invoking its likeness to the 1954 siege at Dien Bien Phu, only in reverse, because we had prevailed. But, as with most things he said about the war, Westy spoke too soon. About a month later, the Battle of Dak To was refought, with elements, 10,000 men strong by the end of it, of the 4th Division, the 1st Air Cav Division, and the 173rd Airborne Brigade taking a tragic pounding. A friend who'd fought with me at Dak To in 1966 was there this time, too, now as a member of the 173rd. He said the fight was a bloodbath, with his brigade alone taking 833 casualties, 191 of them KIA. Once again, the NVA had lured U.S. forces into the most rugged terrain in Vietnam using one of the oldest tricks in the guerrilla handbook, an NVA defector, and even the 173rd's CG Brigadier General Leo H. Schweitzer admitted that the enemy chose the time and place in which decisive engagements would be fought, that only when and where the tactical situation, terrain, battlefield, preparation, and relative strengths of opposing forces favored enemy action were significant contacts initiated. 18 months after Pearson's fight there, no one had learned. 20 American troops were killed when a U.S. fighter aircraft put a bomb right on top of a friendly company. 20 more died when enemy artillery scored a direct hit on the Americans' ammo dumps at Dock Tho. 2 C-130 aircraft were lost and 40 choppers were hit or destroyed. And even if the Americans, 1,644 enemy KIA reported by body count at Dock Tho was an accurate figure to the last man, was it worth the 2,096 airstrikes, almost 1.5 airstrikes per enemy dead, and the expenditure of 151,000 rounds of artillery, 92 rounds per enemy dead it took to get them, or the 344 U.S. troopers who lost their lives, or the 1,441 American WIA? General Westmoreland, meanwhile, was back in the United States during Dock Tho with America's ambassador to Vietnam, Ellsworth Bunker. LBJ had requested their return to beat the "We Are Winning" drum, no doubt in some part because of Secretary of Defense McNamara's public and growing disenchantment with the war. Westy did his commander-in-chief proud during the brief tour, using even the ongoing hugely expensive, in U.S. lives and materiel, Dock Tho battle to signal the beginning of a great defeat for the enemy, and proclaiming in an address before the National Press Club that, "I am absolutely certain that whereas in 1965 the enemy was winning, today he is certainly losing." Perhaps his most amazing cheer was the one that we were now really winning our battle of attrition, that we had raised enemy losses beyond his input capability, and that the enemy's guerrilla force is declining at a steady rate. I was not the only one who found this extremely hard to believe, but even though the events of the next 2 months would prove that Westmoreland's best foot forward in the U.S. ended up right in his mouth in Vietnam, it would not be for nearly a score of years that the country would know that the enemy strength figures had actually been manipulated to back up Westy's claims, and that the Commus MacV had handed out the M1 pencils himself. But, having juggled the figures, Westy must have come to believe them, and when he returned to Vietnam, he enthusiastically embraced the siege on Khe San as the Dien Bien Phu, in reverse, of the war, with the events at Con Tien barely filed away, from which would spring his ever-longed-for set-piece battle that would turn the tide of the war decisively in the Americans' favor. It was only Mao who said, "There is no such thing as a decisive battle in guerrilla warfare." Over a period of months in late 1967 and early 1968, some 40,000 NVA troops surrounded Khe San, an isolated Marine base supplied strictly by air and located near the Laos border. In turn, Westy expanded Khe San to 6,000 Marines in preparation for what he was sure was the inevitable NVA attack. It never came. Instead, for more than 2 months, day and night, day in and day out, while World War II-minded generals warned of the horrors of abandoning the camp, "The western anchor of our defensive line," said one, "that if surrendered would allow the enemy to turn our flank and two or three provinces would be in serious jeopardy," the Marines sat on the receiving end of the same horrific incoming we Hill people had endured in Korea in 1952-53. Throughout the siege, the NVA got theirs too. From B-52s alone, some 75,000 tons, and in casualty figures, 15 to 20 times those of the Marines' 500 KIA. But as Ward Just had titled his book, "To what end was the whole damn thing?" General Jacques knew, even if Westy did not. 11 days after the Khe San siege began, 70,000 communist troops launched a surprise attack on more than 100 cities, towns, and bases throughout South Vietnam almost simultaneously. The attack commenced under the cover of the Tet celebrations, just as Slam and I had discussed a year before, but even I was surprised by the size, violence, and initial success it achieved. The Tet Offensive of 1968 gave the lie to almost everything stated publicly by General Westmoreland and his staff, such as the VC were on their knees, both in strength and morale, and would never be able to mount a sustained attack, or that pacification was working. Almost every city considered to be a secure area in South Vietnam was attacked during Tet of 68. If Westie and company maintained the merest vestige of credibility with the American people after the U.S. Embassy in Saigon was attacked and penetrated by 19 Viet Cong at the outset of the offensive for all the world to watch on the 6 o'clock news, it was lost less than a week into the fighting when the first official body count was announced. The absurdly precise figure of 14,997 enemy KIA to 367 American dead. A week after that, the figure had been rounded off to an incredible 31,000 enemy KIA, but even this trouncing had its price. U.S. casualties were